Catherine and Joseph, welcome to Dreamland.
Thanks for having us back.
Yes, Whitley, it's wonderful to be on. And I have to say, to be on with the two of you together, so I don't know, it's a little bit, if I was a musician, like being on with, you know, the Rolling Stones or something.
I have to tell you that being on with the two of you together is exactly the same for me. Joseph, let's start with you. Start with, if you could give us an overview of the breakaway civilization and what it means to you, because it's out there.
Right. Well, my approach, I kind of backed into this idea of the breakaway civilization, of course, through our colleague Richard Dolan, who wrote in the second of his UFO and National Security State volumes about the hypothesis that there could be a breakaway civilization with access to extremely exotic technologies and sophisticated technologies and techniques and so on. And he wrote that this was also formed in the Cold War matrix, and that dovetails quite a bit with my own research about the Nazi black projects during World War II, and I came to the conclusion that all of this was related. And one of the things that I started to investigate way back when, but I finally wrote about it in a book called Covert Wars and Breakaway Civilizations, was, well, how are you going to finance all this? And I came to the conclusion that part of it had to have been financed on the basis of recovered Axis loot, financial fraud on an industrial scale, through what amounted to, in effect, Whitley, a hidden bond market, which greatly concerns me. I stumbled across the research of Sterling and Peggy Seagrave in their book Gold Warriors, where they talked about a particular bond scandal of the Tanaka government, which was huge. I mean, it was an absolutely huge system of fraudulent bonds that the Tanaka government actually sold. So I think, yes, the bottom line for me is, after World War II, the national security establishment has basically a threefold strategic problem that they're responding to: the communist bloc, whatever this independent group of Nazis were, and then finally, and most importantly, they had a big UFO problem that was self-evident, it was manifest, and they had to have concluded that humanity would have to, number one, kind of stalemate that situation, and number two, institute some long-term project to develop technologies that could demonstrate parity or near parity with UFO performance characteristics, and that's the origin of it for me.
So let's just go back over this, what you just said, and talk briefly about some of the things that flashed past, one of them being, the first one that comes to mind, is the Nazi element that you referred to.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, the Nazi element, as far as I can tell, Whitley, was intimately related to their so-called Bell Project. I've spent a great deal of time in the books trying to reverse engineer not only what I think was the possible physics rationale behind the project, but also to kind of reverse engineer what I think happened to the project after World War II. Nick Cook and Igor Vitkovsky, the two that broke the story in the English language, were of the opinion that the project probably ended up in some American black project's research facility. I took a different tack in that I was able to connect details to the Argentine fusion project of Dr. Ronald Richter that Juan Perón exposed in 1951 at a press conference in Buenos Aires. And there were a number of detailed connections between that project and the Bell. For one thing, Richter had worked on a plasma project in Nazi Germany that sounds very suspiciously like the Bell. He worked on it at the Allgemeine Elektrizitätsgesellschaft, which was the German General Electric. That was, incidentally, the project that Vitkovsky had connected to that company in connection with the Bell. So in other words, we had a corporate connection there. There were connections in some of the concepts that Richter finally talked about to the U.S. Air Force that connected it with the bell. So in other words, it looked to me like there was something going on in Argentina by way of a continuation of some sort of independent Nazi research into all of this avant-garde technology that they were investigating with the bell.
I've often wondered, you know, I have my doubts about whether or not we're even dealing with aliens. But I have often wondered if the Bell Project wasn't something else entirely. For example, the Bell showing up all of those years later, is it obviously, I think it's quite clear that it did, suggests some kind of movement through time, perhaps? Or could it be that using its physics, we broke through into another dimension and something tried to come out or is trying to come out and bite us?
Well, that could be. The Bell Project itself, from what Witkowski uncovered, all that the Bell did in his recounting of the story was it levitated. But interestingly enough, as I pointed out in Reich of the Black Sun and even earlier in Giza Death Star Deployed, the Keksberg object, the Keksberg Acorn, has a number of very weird data set connections to the Bell. They're both of the same dimensions. They're both of the same relative shape. And in the case of the Keksberg Bell, you had the story that was uncovered by Stan Gordon that this object was taken to Wright-Patterson Air Base, where they placed an order for ceramic bricks, which to me was an incredible coincidence. Yeah. If indeed
well,
it was,
let's say
that.
It was not a coincidence. How
yeah,
about that?
Exactly, because the Bell in Witkowski's recounting and reconstruction of the story was tested underground in a ceramic brick lined room. So you know you have a multitude of connection points there that seem to indicate to me that there might be a connection between the two, that they brought the technology to a greater pitch of development, and for whatever reason, the U.S. military and space community heard about it almost instantly. This is the peculiar fact about the Keksberg story, and showed up there and carted off whatever it was that they recovered there. So at that point, yeah, I do think the Bell enters the American Black Projects world. As for time travel, you know, Pace Einstein, if you have any sort of ability to manipulate gravity, that instantaneously in his construction of the mathematics gives you an ability to manipulate time. And I think there is something to that, in that the Bell was tested with a radioactive material. So my rationalization there was, well, why would they do that? And one of the reasons would be that if you are experiencing any sort of very small time dilation effects with the device, one of the things that will happen is it will change the rates of radioactive decay of certain isotopes. So you could measure the field effect of the device by that means. So it's remotely possible that something like that was involved as well.
We're going to take a brief break, folks. When we get back, for those of you who are in the subscriber area, there will be no break. When we get back, we're going to be asking Catherine Austin Fitz about something very, very fascinating about a whole world of hidden economics connected with this. Catherine Austin Fitz's website is Solari.com. Joseph Farrell's website is GizaDeathStar.com. Two of the most extraordinary people out there. They have broken the mold and gone beyond. They understand this world a lot better than it is conventionally understood. We'll be right back. We're talking to Catherine Austin Fitz and Joseph Farrell. Before we left the air, Joseph outlined a number of areas of activity involving UFOs, the Nazi Bell, and other activities which would cost an enormous amount of money. Now, many years ago, when I was involved briefly with some people from the United States Senate, I used to tell them if they wanted to find out what was going on, follow the money. And they did. And some members of the United States Congress joined them. And they discovered, to their amazement, that there were various bases that appeared to be military bases that were not, in fact, on the rosters of any military organization. And they did not know where the people in these bases were being paid from. They appeared to be receiving United States Treasury checks, but this was not the case. That's only what they looked like. Now, Catherine, I have a feeling you might be able to illuminate this little dark corner quite a bit.
Well, I started looking into that corner as a result of following the money as well. And what happened, I was very interested in the health and well-being of places. And what I believed, Whitley, long ago was that the current financial wealth on planet Earth was really a very small portion of what it could be. You know, sort of think in financial terms, we were not optimizing or managing our resources well. And I grew up in a neighborhood that was destroyed by mortgage fraud and narcotics trafficking. And I was very curious, well, why can't we reverse that? And it led to me working in the Bush administration. I was Assistant Secretary of Housing, and diving deeply into what was causing the government money to be spent in sort of very negative, wasteful ways. And I got onto the idea, you know, markets to work need transparency. And so I became very enamored of what relational database technology and the internet could do to bring transparency to, you know, just as we have environmental ecosystems, we have financial ecosystems. And part of optimizing wealth is aligning the health and well-being of our environmental ecosystems and living things with financial wealth and financial ecosystems, if you will. So I was all gung-ho. I left the Bush administration and started a company that would use GIS software to map out financial flows in places. And what I discovered was that if you were free to just optimize both government and private investment in a way that realigned environmental ecosystems with financial ecosystems, you could create massively explosive wealth. And that's before I started to discover all the technology that you could also was available and you could combine with that. And of course, those changes were not allowed to be implemented. I ended up going down the rabbit hole because the databases and software tools we built that sort of showed this were seized by the government and stolen. And what I discovered was that there is an enormous amount of both government and private money that is literally disappearing down the hole. Imagine, if you will, as if the whole planet was being organized and run to produce a tithe. And you can call it, Joseph has done some great speeches on the hidden system of finance and the sort of hidden bond market. I talk about the black budget, but, you know, between the hidden system of finance and the black budget and covert and organized crime cash flows, we're watching an economy being run to produce enormous amounts of funds that are literally disappearing into a non-transparent, you know, behind a one-way mirror. And what is extraordinary is not only how much money it is, but the dysfunction it causes to the rest of the economy, because we have an entire overt economy and overt financial system where everybody's pretending that this isn't happening.
Right. It's completely invisible on the overt level, too.
Well, it's remarkable. You know, I've studied very carefully how they've managed to organize, whether it's an economy in a town or a city or a county. You know, they've managed to organize the economy so that, you know, the lion's share of the economy is absolutely invisible. It's quite an extraordinary feat. And, of course, many of these operations are invisible as well. So, but the reality is that the lies of what's going on are almost as expensive financially as the money that's disappearing. Because when you try and run an economy, when you try and run a household, when you try and run a budget, when you try and run a business, when you try and run your personal savings and investments, and everything around you is full of what I call material emissions, and you don't have a basic map of financial reality and economic reality, you're in real trouble. And one of the reasons that you know, I have searched out and found Joseph and other people like Richard Dolan and yourselves is, you know, if I as a financial person am going to make sense of the financial system and the economy, a bigger and bigger portion of the economy is certainly organized around these phenomena and driven by these phenomena, not to mention that these cash flows, Whitley, have financed the most powerful technology available on the planet. And he who controls that technology controls the world.
Now, and when so, you say which technology are you referring to, or should I ask Joseph?
Joseph, I'll lob it to you, Joseph.
Well,
before you answer, Joseph, we got to take a break.
Sure.
Okay. Joseph Farrell's website, GizaDeathStar.com, Catherine Austin Fitt's website, Solari.com. Don't miss either one of them. Keep up with them. Go and explore these sites. There are plenty of ways for you to become involved in both websites and in both authors, and it's important that you do so. We'll be right back. We're talking to Catherine Austin Fitz and Joseph Farrell about the breakaway civilization, its function, and its finance. And just before we left the air, Joseph was about to talk to us about about this enormously important technology that it is secretly financing.
Well, I think, Whitley, we're dealing with a whole variety of technologies, to be quite frank with you. Let's look at the implant that you described.
Right, in my ear.
In your ear. Clearly, this is some sort of perhaps biometric telemetry technology.
It was partly alive. When it was examined by a pathologist, he said it had the cilia on it, were motile, they were alive. He'd never seen anything like it. And they were based in a metallic base. And also, I didn't mention this, it went into my ear without the slightest sign of a scar. There was only a red lump there.
Yep. Yeah, clearly they've developed combination type technologies that rely on biological processes as well as ordinary mechanical and electromagnetic processes. So that would be obviously an expensive technology to develop. Normally we also think of exotic propulsion technologies. We certainly know, Whitley, of the work of Thomas Townsend Brown. I covered a lot of that in Covert Wars and Clash of Civilizations, demonstrating that he actually ended up at the period of the mid-1950s onward, doing various work for classified projects, and had a connection to Lockheed Martin, incidentally. And that, plus the statements of Ben Rich about finding an error in the equations, and now we have the technology to take E.T. home, the work of Mark McCandlish that many of your audience would be familiar with the alien reconstruction vehicle that he's been actively pursuing and trying to kind of reverse engineer the physics of that and describe the actual technologies involved. All of this, to my mind, indicates that they instituted right around 1947 with the National Security Act in the wake of Roswell and the Kenneth Arnold sightings and so on, indicates to me that they put into place a very long-term mega Manhattan project to develop a technological parity, or at least near parity, with what they were observing from UFO characteristics and performance. So that's going to require an enormous amount of money over a prolonged period of time, and this is what I backed into, and this is what Catherine backed into, and quite frankly, I think this is what Richard Dolan.
I'm hoping that I will be able to get Richard Dolan on the show at some point. And I'll have him listen to what we're talking about today, and we'll go with him from there when we're able to reach him. He was scheduled to be on this program. We simply can't reach him.
Whitley, let me give you a sense of the extraordinary extent of the financial issues, because I think it's, you know, it was certainly hard for me to understand, having run the Federal Housing Administration, how could all of this money be disappearing and me not know? And so oftentimes when people hear this, they say, how could this be going on and me not know? Since money started to go missing in size from the federal government, I was part of a group of people in the Bush administration who were able to pass laws requiring audited financial statements. And so a process began in 1995 where the government would report what's called its undocumentable adjustments. So let me explain what an undocumentable adjustment is. If you have a checking account and the balance in your checking account is $2,000 and the bank sends you a statement that says you have $500, rather than figure out where the difference came from, you just write undocumentable adjustment $1,500. And voila, you've balanced your checkbook. So the undocumentable adjustments and undocumentable transactions since 1995 when that process started are now up to $12 trillion.
Yeah, and I can remember right before 9/11, it was a rather large undocumentable adjustment that was mentioned in passing by the
Secretary
Donald Rumsfeld, right, exactly.
On September 10th and said there's $2.3 trillion. That was in 1 year. So you had $1.1 trillion missing 1 year, $2.3 trillion missing. And then, you know, when everybody started to get onto that, Rumsfeld announced it. The next day we had 9/11. And here's what was very interesting. President Bush then recommended a $48 billion increase for DOD. Can you imagine? And It was the following year, I went to a town hall meeting with a congressman who was on both the budget and defense appropriation subcommittee and said to him, Congressman, there's $3.3 trillion missing from the Department of Defense over the last 2 years. He said, yes, I know. And I said, what are you doing about it? And he said, nothing. There's nothing I can do.
Now, that's an incredible statement.
Let me give you another incredible statement. I was visiting that same summer with the chief of staff to the senator who runs the appropriations subcommittee for the 21 agencies, including HUD. Now, within the scheme of Washington, a senator who controls the appropriations subcommittee is the most powerful person, you know, arguably more powerful than OMB in the scheme of pecking orders of government money. And this was somebody I didn't know very well, and they said, what do you think is going on at HUD? Actually, it was the summer before, so it was Andrew Cuomo was still secretary. It was the summer before. Said, what do you think is going on at HUD? And I said, I don't know. What do you think is going on at HUD? And they looked me dead in the eye, and they said, HUD is being run as a criminal enterprise. Now, here's what's interesting. HUD is on a matrix structure, and you cannot run HUD as a criminal enterprise unless the Department of Justice, the New York Fed, the New York Fed member banks, the Treasury run it as a criminal enterprise. Now, I said to this person, I don't disagree, that summer the committee voted out a huge increase in HUD's appropriations.
My word. I mean, what you're saying, I mean, folks, are you really listening to this? This is incredible.
Well, remember, as we have developed a secret financial system, we have also developed, as a parallel, a secret slavery system. You know, people think of senators and congressmen as powerful, but when you're dealing with a breakaway civilization, remember, you're dealing with people who have the ability to kill with impunity. Okay,
right.
Look at the story you told. And so whether it's mind control technology, whether it's control files, whether it's the ability to blackmail or threaten or kill your, you know, the people you love, or, you know, the ability to offer you all sorts of personnel benefits, we're literally talking about a civilization which can implement its will and has literally, even at the highest echelons of society, created a secret, you know, a secret slavery system, which is part of servicing and running the secret financial system.
Right. Now, we're going to take a break we're coming to the end of the first half hour of Dreamland, and we're going to go on afterwards in an open conversation, which I'm going to start out with, and I have no idea whether or not either of you can answer this or would be able to approach it in some way, but I would like to see what you say. And that is, this thing has been in my ear for a long time. I wonder if I am under mind control or not. This is Whitley Strieber. This has been Dreamland. We are talking to Catherine Austin Fitz and Joseph Farrell. Catherine's website, Solari GizaDeathStar.com, Joseph's website, GizaDeathStar.com. Both of them have numerous avenues with which you can engage with them. Do so. It is important to your welfare and your right to understand the world in which you live. There is no reason a senator may be captured and enslaved by a hidden power. You do not need to be. You need to be active in defense of your freedom, not passive. They stand ready to help. Thank you very much for being with us, both of you, on Dreamland. Remember, folks, next week we're back with more on the breakaway civilization and Richard Dolan, the world's leading expert on just that, joins me, Catherine, and Joseph, and we go even deeper. Subscribe is with you, Richard. If you could give us an idea of what you feel the breakaway civilization is, and then later, folks, we're going to go into its technologies, and for you, Catherine, into its social presence in the world and what it's doing, and Joseph, its historical significance and where it came from. I think that it's going to be a terrific show. So I'll start with you, Richard, by asking you this question. What is it that makes you feel the breakaway civilization exists? And you can take your time. Believe me, you don't have to, however, repeat an entire book. Just the main points.
Thank you, Whitley. Well, I don't think I need to take a lot of time because I've been thinking about this for the past 5 years or more. It's always been one of the big ideas in my head, and I haven't been able to let go of it. I'll deal with it in two ways. One is I'll tell you why I think there is such a thing as a breakaway civilization. And then the next, which I think you were hinting at just a moment ago, I would offer my opinion on how far along I think it may be, which I looked at as kind of a spectrum. But I think that there is such a thing as a breakaway civilization. And just really simply how the idea formed in my mind years ago is, you know, having studied the history of a variety of civilizations of the past, and specifically having read Arnold J. Toynbee, who was a great historian of civilizations back in his day, he actually did a typology of study of them. It's quite fascinating. In any case, it was clear to me that we have had, even in the last century, different types of civilizations here on planet Earth. You have, during the Cold War, the American infrastructure, the Soviet infrastructure. There was common ground, but there was also a lot of separateness among them. At the same time, it was clear to anyone who looks at this that we're in this trend of globalization, a merging of civilizations. So it's I think, almost counterintuitive for many of us to think, well, in that kind of an environment, can we actually have, like, the existence of a totally separate group? But I think the answer is yes. When you look at the history of the black budget, particularly the U.S. black budget, but let us also, expand that definition. There's during the Second World War, the Germans pioneered this idea. The Russians, the Soviets after the war, developed it also. But within the United States, we've had a significant off the main path black budget world, much of which, not all of which, but much of which I think has been connected to the UFO reality. I've argued for years that the UFO phenomenon has been a key instigator of what we call black budget culture. So if you take the idea of this secret infrastructure in terms of funding, in terms of military secrecy, and then you throw in things like ET technology, or let's just be cautious and say technology that doesn't seem to have originated from our civilization, which I think is exactly what did happen, you have a situation where secrecy is mandated. From the point of view of those people managing the secret, it's not a possibility that they would allow ordinary people to have access to such exotic technology, particularly if it gives you a new energy paradigm, post-petroleum, weapons that might not be able to be controlled, and so on. And so that, therefore, the study of this would be ultra-secret. The patents on those breakthroughs would be classified, and you would have a situation where most of the world is not permitted to pursue those classified patents and those classified breakthroughs, but the classified world is, of course. And if you're holding the mainstream world hostage, as it were, and not permitting them to make these breakthroughs, meanwhile the classified world is running far ahead, you're in a situation where quite accurately we can say that the scientific understanding, even the cosmology and many of the other fundamental pieces of knowledge of that classified world, are just in danger of racing far, far ahead of the rest of us, so much so that they could have a different cosmology. They would have different technological breakthroughs that could allow them to build, for example, their own versions of flying saucers. Why not? And if they can do that, that can allow them to go off-world. If they can go off-world more easily, they can explore aspects of our solar system that the rest of us can't. They would have interactions and understandings that the rest of us lack. In short, making them, in effect, a separate civilization, one that's broken away from our own. I believe that is exactly what has happened. I think that the logic mandates it, and I also think that there have been a number of significant leaks from that world that have supported this. So that's why I believe there's a breakthrough civilization.
Now, let me ask you this. You say a number of significant leaks. Could you give us some idea of what you mean?
For sure. Let's talk about the moon. You have a number of individuals who have stated very plainly their access to knowledge about structures and, let us even say, what look like bases on the far side of the moon. We've heard this a number of times. There's the well-known testimony of a gentleman named Carl Wolf, who back in the 1960s had an encounter with an NSA photo analyst. And Carl Wolf spoke about this many times. He's available on YouTube. He's very explicit, and he said during the mid-60s, he had the one opportunity to see these images. He knew he was not cleared for them, which made him frightened. But this other analyst was showing him these, what were obvious to Wolf, structures, geometric shapes on the far side of the moon that were photographed, some of the earliest digital photography that the U.S. military was employing at this time. A woman named Donna Hare, who did not directly have the information, but spoke explicitly about her conversations with many of the U.S. astronauts during the early 70s, who she maintained, again, very adamantly, that they were telling her clearly about UFO encounters out on the moon, out in space, and so forth. I had my own experience with the scientist Russell Targ, who helped to formulate the remote viewing program out of the Stanford Research Institute. And Russell told me explicitly a number of years ago that during the early 1980s, one of his jobs was to train remote viewers at Fort Meade, Maryland, whose job was to remote view the far side of the moon. That kind of blew me away. I said, well, why would they do that? Russell Lee said, why do you think? And a bit of a pause, and I said, well, I don't know, were they looking for extraterrestrials? And he said, yes. I asked him if they found extraterrestrials, these remote viewers, and he said, I don't know, that wasn't part of my job. But I believe him, and I think he was telling me what he knew. So in other words, there's this activity. If nothing else, there's something going on with the moon. And I think there are certainly a number of anomalies in Earth orbit that have been recorded that also show things that are not supposed to exist. These are not all ice crystals.
Yes.
So there's activity happening here. To me, that is symptomatic of a massive infrastructure. Again, that is not supposed to exist, but there it is. And some of that may not be ours, but some of that probably is ours.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we're going to get into a little bit about what they may be doing. In other words, what are their motives, and how do they affect our lives? We'll be right back. We're talking to Catherine Austin Fitz, Joseph Farrell, and Richard Dolan. Catherine's website is solari.com. That's solari.com. On solari.com, you can get the Solari Report. You can get frequent Solari email updates. You can listen to the Solari podcast. You can understand your world. What is going on economically? Richard Dolan's website is richarddolanpress.com. Did you know that Richard Dolan is a publisher of not only his own books, but of some of the most remarkable books you will find out there? The FBI, CIA, UFO connection, More recently, a new release from Laurie MacDonald, Ghost Hunter and Reiki Master, Help for the Haunted, A Guide to Dealing with Spiritual Infestation. Don't miss Richard Dolan Press, a fascinating, very well-informed man, one of the most interesting people and one of the most interesting publishers in the world. Joseph Farrell's website is GizaDeathStar.com. That's GizaDeathStar.com. Joseph is a prolific author, blogger, and video blogger. Don't miss his video blog, News from the Nefarium. Plus, keep up with his latest every single day. This is a very active website, and you have only to look in the books section to realize this is one of the most brilliant, prolific, and dedicated authors in the world. GizaDeathStar.com has a great deal to offer you. We're talking to Joseph Farrell, Richard Dolan, and Catherine Austin Fitz about the breakaway civilization. Later in the subscriber area, Anne and I are going to bring up some information about that we know that I don't think is general knowledge at all. I've never seen it anywhere. We know it through friends about something that used to happen periodically in the gas chambers in the death camps that is shocking and unknown, but that might be very related to this in a deep and fascinating way. But in any case, right now, I want to try to find out, we speak of something on the far side of the moon, etc., a rather breathtaking possibility that this exists. But why does it exist? Catherine, you're involved in the world of economics and finance. What would be the motivation of people who would be doing this? In other words, why not tell the world, and why not become immensely wealthy by patenting extraordinary technological materials and so on and so forth? Instead, they're so hidden. Do you have any sense of why?
Well, you're asking the wrong person, Woodley, because I would argue for transparency. I think everybody on this call
agree. I would argue for transparency, too. But what I'm trying to figure out is, why isn't it? I mean, it seems like it should be. It seems like the logical thing to do.
Here's what I can tell you, is if you understand how the global financial system is organized, a great deal of it organizes around the management of the reserve currency and the U.S. federal budget, particularly the U.S. federal credit. And that whole system as a financial ecosystem is very much organized around harvesting the planet and producing money for what Richard just described as the black budget. And I think the thing to understand about what you're talking about, what the breakaway civilization is it's leaving a large financial footprint throughout the economy. If you look at, let me take it down to a household or community level. If you look at every household and community, they are paying an enormous tax to finance whatever this is, not only in terms of the what I call the negative return on investment on government investment.
That's you and me, folks, so keep listening.
Right, a huge tax from organized crime. I think a lot of, you know, there's a common popular myth that a lot of organized crime is just corruption as opposed to systemic process to produce money for these activities. Finally, it means you have to have a very managed economy, and so we're functioning now without an absence of the kind of price that market provides, which is essential for human communication, particularly economic communication. And finally, a great line the other night from Jim Norman, who said that economic warfare is always surrounded by a thick bodyguard of lies. The lies are very expensive. If anybody, you know, if you're a child and you have to spend thousands of years in school learning misinformation and disinformation, it's a very heavy tax. So, you know, right now, I always tell people if a group of soccer moms get together to back the drugs out of their community, you know, they cut off the money to Tony Soprano, which cuts off the money to James Bond, and the next thing you know, they have black helicopters on their head. And I think the way I came onto this, because I was very skeptical, and the thing that finally led me to find Richard and find Dr. Farrell and learn more about what is really going on is if you look at the amount of money that is going missing, the inability of the federal government to re-engineer its budget because all of this is secret so they can't re-engineer the black budget, and the amount of money that is spent on the technology of control, because the expense of keeping whatever this is secret is not only enormous but growing.
And yes, and it is becoming, it seems to me, more and more unwieldy. Now, Joseph, you have made the case that there are two nodes, at least two nodes in this. One of them goes back into the Nazi era, and the other one perhaps involves alien technology. Mm-hmm. Now, I would like to ask if you are aware of what Linda Howe and I worked on in the summer of 2007, which were these so-called drones, these enormous things that appeared in Northern California and the Isaac materials showing some very strange and extraordinary drawings and pictures of what appeared to be alien technology. Are you familiar with that?
No, I'm not, but
okay.
But
you can answer the question anyway. It doesn't matter. go ahead and say what you were going to say anyway.
Well, for me, the two indicators of a breakaway civilization here, in addition to the UFO problem, and I think you have to look at the conclusions that the national security establishment came to in 1948, and this is something that Richard has emphasized in his books, that even though they were considering at the time that some of this had to have been human-based and perhaps linked to some of the Nazi technology, there was just far too many incidents of UFOs and physics signatures that were far beyond anything that the Nazis did at the time. So they came to the conclusion that this might be coming from somewhere else. So they were looking at a huge infrastructure, and that's the first thing that I think that would have concerned them, because they had to build this infrastructure in order to achieve emulation of any sort of technological parity or near parity with what they were seeing. So that's the first clue. It's a technological clue. But the second one, for me, I think the template for constructing this breakaway group, as Richard indicated, is something that dates back to World War II, to the infrastructures that this country put into place with the Manhattan Project, and then inside the Third Reich with the infrastructures that they put into place for all of their advanced weapons projects, which were quite literally a state within the state. Albert Speer pointed this out in some of his books, that they had created a huge hidden SS economy that was being run by the slave labor on the camps, and that this was all for the purpose of manufacturing and researching these weapons. So they had a huge infrastructure that was completely hidden from the normal war machine in Nazi Germany. And I think this too served as a template for what the United States did in the post-war period with regard to the UFO problem. But there's a second component to this that began to intrigue me, and that was the financial aspect. How are you going to finance all this? If you're going to create a project that is designed to emulate to the degree possible the performance characteristics of UFOs, then you're going to have a funding mechanism for it. So they can't come right out and say, well, we're going to tax everybody to death because we've got this off-world problem that we're dealing with. They have to keep this secret, so they have to put into place a long-term hidden financial system that, like Catherine has indicated, is there to harvest the economy of the world, and this system has to remain completely hidden. And for me, I kind of backed into this by looking at all the Axis loot that just kind of drops right off the radar screen after World War II. And lo and behold, you discover that in 1947, that extraordinarily crucial year, when you had the Kenneth Arnold sightings, when you had the Roswell incident, when you had the National Security Act, it was also in the same year that President Truman took the decision to utilize all this Axis loot, particularly the Japanese loot, and create a hidden system of finance. He literally made this a top secret system of finance. And the implication of this, Whitley, I think is profound, especially for Richard's hypothesis that you're dealing with a breakaway civilization, and that is that what this does, effectively, is it puts the national security apparatus, the intelligence agencies, directly into the banking business. So they're going to use all sorts of techniques to harvest the wealth. They're going to use market manipulation. They're going to obfuscate the figures of gold and silver bullion available in the world. They're going to sell securities on hidden bond markets. I think that's very clear that this was done. So for me, the indicators are twofold. They're technological and they're financial.
Yeah. Interesting that they would be like that both. And I think that I want to ask each of you in turn the same question. We're going to take another break, and then I'm going to ask each of you in turn the same question. And that is the breakaway civilization, in your view, a bulwark against something, or is it an extension of something that is out there? In other words, does the breakaway civilization serve us and defend us, or does it serve something else and are we its victims? Now, don't answer yet. I'll be right back, and when I get back, we'll start with Catherine. We'll be right back. Richard Dolan's website is richarddolanpress.com. Did you know that Richard Dolan is a publisher of not only his own books, but of some of the most remarkable books you will find out there? The FBI, CIA, UFO connection. More recently, a new release from Laurie MacDonald, Ghost Hunter and Reiki Master, Help for the Haunted, A Guide to Dealing with Spiritual Infestation. Don't miss Richard Dolan Press, a fascinating, very well-informed man, one of the most interesting people, and one of the most interesting publishers in the world. We're talking to Catherine Austin Fitz, Joseph Farrell, and Richard Dolan. Catherine's website is solari.com. That's solari.com. On solari.com, you can get the Solari Report. You can get frequent Solari email updates. You can listen to the Solari podcast. You can understand your world. What is going on economically? Richard Dolan's website is Catherine Austin Fitz will tell you, and she is one of the few people who can. Joseph Farrell's website is GizaDeathStar.com. That's GizaDeathStar.com. Joseph is a prolific author, blogger, and video blogger. Don't miss his video blog, News from the Nefarium. Plus, keep up with his latest every single day. This is a very active website, and you have only to look in the books section to realize this is one of the most brilliant, prolific, and dedicated authors in the world. GizaDeathStar.com has a great deal to offer you. This is Whitley Strieber. We're talking to Catherine Austin Fitz, Joseph Farrell, and Richard Dolan about the breakaway civilization. Before we left the air, I asked the question, basically, is it for us or against? Is it dangerous to us? Is it an instrument being used by some kind of hostile force, perhaps to enslave us? Or is it a bulwark, a defense system? Catherine, let me start with you. What is your impression, looking at the way the financial structure of the world works? Are we delivering value to somebody, or in other words, like tribute, or are we being served by something we're having to pay a great deal for?
Whitley, it's a great question. I don't know the answer. We see aspects and behavior that would imply and argue for either case. And in fact, you know, sometimes you feel like you're dealing with something that has multiple personality disorder. So part of it is whatever we're dealing with is very big, it's very complex, it's dealing with complex phenomena, it's also dealing with uncertainty, and it's a big planet, Whitley. It's very, very hard and difficult to run an entire planet by force, which is what increasingly they're trying to do. And operationally, it's a nightmare to maintain productivity when your very protocols destroy productivity. So trying to run this thing as a national security state, to me, is operationally close to insanity. So I think the big question is, you know, who are they? What are they afraid of? Why are they behaving this way? And I think the answer is we don't know. And one of the reasons I came to this is day-to-day I'm an investment advisor. And there's nothing more frustrating if you're trying to manage money than to not understand the governance system of the planet, particularly if we're going to manage economies where price is managed, price is not free to trade. You know, price is a national security decision, not a market. It doesn't emerge from market dynamics. And so it becomes very important to understand the governance system. And I believe under the law to not ask these questions, you know, this is a material omission. And so having an entire financial community pretend that trillions of dollars are not going missing down a black hole and this is not going on is, you know, is deeply troubling.
Well, it is deeply troubling, and because it in fact is going on. And when I was back in 2006, I began to see clearly that all of these mortgage bundles that were being created and sold had to be fake, because they were only as valuable as the least valuable component in them, and you couldn't tell what that was. You didn't know what the quality of the paper underlying inside the bundle was.
Well,
go ahead.
Whitley, I often tell the story of meeting with the chief of staff to the appropriator for HUD and many of the agencies, including Treasury, in the early 2000s. And they said to me, what do you think is going on in HUD? And I was trying to be discreet, and I said, I don't know, what do you think is going on in HUD? And they said HUD is being run as a criminal enterprise. Now, here's what's important to understand. HUD is run on a matrix structure that requires the New York Fed member banks, who run the exchange stabilization as agent for Treasury, and do tremendous amounts of servicing in the mortgage and related areas, Treasury, the Department of Justice, and the Federal Reserve, all are operationally necessary to run it as a criminal enterprise, and then the execution often falls to the defense contractors, including, you know, the very defense contractors who really build up Area 51 and many of the sort of operations that you read when you read Richard's book. So, you know, that's not corruption. That's a system. That's a very deeply complex system that's well engineered and has lots of legal mechanisms to keep it secret and to keep the money flowing. So you're really talking about an enormous financial infrastructure using the federal credit that is an institution. It is not corruption. It is not a mistake. It's not an accident. It's a very significant aspect of the entire financial system, and it dovetails, as Joseph said, with this hidden system of finance, which is much more an offshore phenomena. And the two of them combined create the most powerful aspect of the financial system on the planet.
And here we are with talk about a monkey on our backs. This is a 100-pound gigantic gorilla on our backs, and we are really struggling under the weight of this thing, and it ain't over yet. The destabilization that's occurring, we're only in the middle of that. That hasn't ended. Now, I'd like to next go, if I could, to you, Joseph, and essentially ask you the same question. Is the breakaway civilization defending us or delivering us to someone?
Well, it's interesting that you asked this question, because it's a question that I kind of attempted to address in a roundabout fashion at the conference that Catherine and Richard and I spoke at last June. What I was trying to do in my first talk was and second one was to try and kind of reverse engineer the policy formation culture of the post-war national security establishment. And I came to the conclusion, I've written about this in a couple of my recent books, that what we're looking at is not only this huge infrastructure, but we're looking at various factions within it. And they're going to attempt to do various things in confronting the UFO phenomenon. They're going to try to stalemate it. In other words, they're going to attempt to respond to some of the more provocative actions that UFOs have exhibited and demonstrate a human capacity of resistance. But at the same time, I think they're going to resort to all of the standard tricks of the intelligence community. They're going to run psychological operations not only against humans that express an interest in the UFO problem, but they're also going to attempt to run psychological operations against whoever it is that they think they're dealing with. And part of this operation is they're going to attempt to make some sort of contact or come to some sort of understanding of what all of this is about. So I think in the long run, you have to entertain both possibilities. They're both attempting to defend, but like you phrased the question, some of this vast amount of money, and Catherine and I have talked about this as well in some of our discussions, part of this money may be going off-world not simply to fund whatever off-world presence humanity may have established on the moon or elsewhere using these advanced technologies, but part of it may be going in the form of some sort of off-world tribute or tithe or perhaps even some sort of trade. We simply don't know. But whatever's going on, it's huge. And like Catherine says, they've erected this system to keep the cash flow going. The real mystery, and the way I kind of come to this conclusion, is if you look at the scale of all of the quantitative easing that's been done recently, not to mention similar things that were done all the way back to the Reagan administration, and even for that matter, you can go back to Nixon. If you look at the sheer scale of all this finance, the financial analysts that are looking at all of this in terms of conventional analysis have been predicting hyperinflation not only since the bailout, but as far as I can remember, and this has not happened.
No.
So I'm looking at this, you know, I'm looking at this kind of like an electrical circuit, with money being the current in the circuit. Where is all this money going? It's not appearing at the load end on planet Earth. So, to my mind, this means that you've got another aspect of the circuit that's not visible. It's going somewhere.
You know, that's absolutely fascinating, because what you're saying is something that has really mystified me, and that is, but of course hyperinflation's not happening because the money is not actually coming into the economy.
Right.
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 I want to go on now. We're coming to the end of Dreamland. And ask you the same question, Richard, and then we're going to go on into the special part of the interview where I'm going to bring up some things that I think are probably going to startle all three of you, but I think you're going to have some really interesting stuff to say about them. Richard, what is your impression of the breakaway civilization and its motives?
Yes. I first want to just say that, first of all, it's a delight being on here with Joseph and Catherine and yourself, Whitley. Their financial insights into the breakaway civilization was an important piece that I hadn't really formulated, excuse me, myself. And so what they're saying, pardon me, something just went down the wrong pipe at the wrong moment. What they're saying, I think, makes perfect sense to me. And I think what Joseph was just saying about money going elsewhere, let us say, out of our financial system, there's a strong logic to that, actually, and I think this is an opportunity for further research. And the other thing I just wanted to mention real quickly is the Isaac documents and the Dragonfly drones is something that I did follow along with, you know, your research and Linda Moulton Howe's research, and I think that there's something very, very important to that, and what Isaac's documents simply suggested is that there was a very strong program going on in Silicon Valley in the early 1980s to replicate and at least study this exotic technology. Relating to the breakaway civilization and motives, my feeling is that it started out initially as a reflexive, defense of, let's just say, the human race. I mean, let us think back to the 1940s, think back to the political structure, and just imagine being in the position of someone like Harry Truman, being given this unbelievable information that not only are there others here, but we've acquired some of their bodies and technology. It's not hard to see why the necessity for absolute secrecy would be in place. If for no other reason, then how would a president answer questions from the public about the motives of these other beings when, you know, you yourself, the president, probably can't answer it? This is a political nightmare beyond anything we can imagine. So, of course, they're going to be careful about that. And secondarily, to find out, what are we dealing with? Are they friend or foe? And then how do we manage this technology and keep it from our enemies? And all of those logical questions, that's exactly what happened. And my feeling is that from at least their point of view, those decision makers probably saw what they were doing as justified, as even ethical and moral, despite the fact that it essentially was a knife in the back of the classical American republic, because now you've got to fund this research and development without Congress knowing and all of that. But it's not hard for me to see that they...
But there are elements of Congress that do know, and the presidency knows something.
I don't argue against that, but certainly I would also be of the opinion that this is a very limited number of members of Congress who would be brought into this secret.
Yeah.
And the further you go into the world of special access programs, which all grew out of this, I think it's even more extreme. But what I think happened with this breakaway civilization, desperate attempt to try to catch up to these other beings, certainly an attempt to weaponize the technologies that came into their their possession, hiding the energy and propulsion breakthroughs and more. So now they've gotten to a point where not only are they making money off of at least the patents that they're getting out of this, but they have this disclosure paralysis where they're probably, I'm sure, terrified of criminal charges if this secret ever comes out, and equally terrified of the global transformation that would eliminate our petroleum infrastructure. So therefore, what I believe is they've really become anathema to human interests. So I think that they've started out as a reflexive defense of human civilization, and over the decades and generations have morphed into something else, because this is what I see as their goals. What I see right now is that there's a foot race, and the foot race is between ordinary people on the one hand and these elite individuals who are involved in the breakaway civilization on the other. I think they know as well as anyone else that secrecy on this topic cannot indefinitely be maintained the way our civilization is. We have internet, we've got interconnectivity in all these different ways. We've got WikiLeaks, we have Anonymous, we have Edward Snowden, and all of that. So what they're trying to do is nail down a global, transnational, legal and financial and intellectual structure, corporate friendly, of course, that will supersede national laws, that will create a kind of a global system of total surveillance and intimidation, and will turn the web into TV, maintain total control of a global intellectual life before certain key breakthroughs are made, whether it's in leaked secrets or any kind of sharing of information that will go against that. So I think, in other words, what the existence of this massive amount of secrecy has prompted those individuals to want to create a global totalitarian system.
I agree with you completely, and I think that what we are seeing with the massive increase in surveillance, especially in the free societies, in particular in the United States and Great Britain, is the beginning of preparation for this process, which is going to be, I think, a very extraordinary and difficult change in the way humanity lives and is, because if what was going to happen was something we would want, no one would be bothering to set up this enormous infrastructure. You can, at this point, literally push a button and the Anglo-Saxon world becomes a police state.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, now, wait, folks. We've come to the end of Dreamland.